And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. Hey, I've got a new headset. We're going to see how this works. You know, I've been trying to find something that would work better for, so I don't have to keep leaning up to the mic all the time. And I had Dr. Michael Masters on, who had a headset that sounded great. So I ordered it. It's here. Hopefully it'll sound as good as it does when he's using it. Also, other people are using the same mic in the trade. So we'll see how this works out. My guest tonight is Dr. Bruce Maccabee. He'll be coming up in a little bit. First, filling in for Alejandro is the one and only Lee Spiegel. He'll be on in just a second. I want to say that next week I have, as you know, longtime listeners especially, I've always figured out a way to do a show, even when traveling overseas or anywhere. But this next week, it's absolutely impossible. And I have to support my lavish lifestyle, I guess. I am going to be working at a location on an estate where there's absolutely no internet, just barely a one or two bar signal. And I have to stay there at the house for the entire week next week. So I'm not going to be available for a show. However, I already have set up a first time to YouTube is an interview back in 2013 and or even earlier, I believe. Yeah, 2013. I have an interview set up that you will find most enjoyable. And that's also going to be a rerun for all of the longtime podcast listeners and supporters. The free show and the member show is all going to be that. Speaking of members, a number of people have told me they have had trouble. They do not want to use PayPal. And I guess Patreon has other ways of people supporting a show. So I have a membership now on Patreon. I already have a supporter. Thank you, Chris. He's also the one that strongly suggested I do it. So that is now available. The link is right on podcastufo.com if anyone wants to support through Patreon. And I will, once you support the show, I will give you the link and the free, the access to the 2 hour shows and a complete guide on how to set that up with your media player. So again, where you can support the show through our website, or drop down menu there under support the show, or through Patreon. And, anyway, thank you all for supporting. If you can't support the show, I still appreciate you listening. And with that, we'll start out with our fill-in news guy today, Lee Spiegel. Hey, Lee, welcome to the show.
Well, hello, Martin. I'm very happy to be your current fill-in guy. Yeah.
Yes, thanks for filling in. But you also, I was inviting you on anyway because you have, you want to talk about your new show coming up. So let's do that. First, let's just talk about your show coming up, the time where someone can watch it, and all the info you can give us.
Well, now, are we talking about radio or otherwise?
No, let's talk about we'll talk about the other part later. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm looking very much forward to joining you and the KGRA family when I premiere my new radio show next week. It's right around the corner, and it's called Edge of Reality Radio. And it's kind of a half premiere and half resurrection of my previous talk show that was called, coincidentally, Edge of Reality. It first hit the airwaves nearly 40 years ago on NBC Radio in New York. And wow, a lot has happened since then in the whole field of UFO studies. Mm. And as you know, from all the work that you've done, the people you've interviewed, we're at a point right now, historically, where the ridicule factor has diminished a great deal. Mm. people aren't as afraid of reporting strange things that they've seen in the day or night sky. Plus, the way that the media reports close encounters, that's evolved to the point where it's not just kind of relegated to a news item that's saved for the very end of the 11 o'clock news each night. Mm. That seems to be a thing of the past, I'm happy to note.
You're absolutely right about that. And it makes, I think I talked about it last week, I'm not so embarrassed to actually talk about it in my when I'm out and about and actually doing my professional life. I'm not so worried about it anymore.
Oh, that's an interesting point, because there are many people who have other things that they do for a living, and the UFO part of their world is almost secondary, and in many cases it should be, because people need to actually live and earn a living.
That's right.
But it doesn't mean that they can't be serious investigators of something that seriously needs to be investigated, and you know that, you know, much closer than most people I know.
That's right. That's right. So let's see. They can catch it right here. Actually, if you're listening live on KGRA right now, you can catch it there. And it's Thursday evenings again. What is it? 8 to 10? Is that?
Yes. Edge of Reality Radio will premiere Thursday, August 1st from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time on KGRA. And just so that you and your audience knows, each week, won't just be about UFOs. There's a lot of road to cover in what I like to call the overlapping world of science and unexplained phenomena. We're going to look at things like ghosts, the possibility of life after death, the scientific search for other realities and universes. One of my favorites, time travel, strange creatures reported from around the world, and, you know, recent advances in what we now know about human consciousness. And there's a lot going on with that kind of research. So I'm looking forward to just taking the listeners on an eye-opening excursion of the wonders of the world that are all around us, because I'll learn in the same process as the listeners will. That's why I do this, Martin, is because I don't know everything about all of these things. This is a great idea. It's a great ability for me to learn as much as I hope to bring to the audience. So this is great for all of us, I think.
I totally understand. Although I will say, how many years have I been doing this show? Eight years? Just about 8 years. I know just as much as I did in the beginning about UFOs. I don't want to say that I know anything more about UFOs. However, I will say that I've heard in the 8 years that I've been doing this show, I've heard some amazing things that enough to keep me going. And it's actually still exciting for me, just to listen to, even if I don't agree with what someone is saying, it's still very interesting to me to hear people's thoughts about the possibilities of what we may be seeing. I think it's all fascinating.
Listen, I think you're wrong.
Okay.
But only on one point. I think you, Martin Willis, you do know more now than you did when you first started reporting on this. And what I mean by that is, to people who say to me, "Oh, I can't believe that stuff you're interested in. I'm a real scoffer at that kind of stuff." My response to them is, how much personal time have you looked into this particular subject? How much time have you either read books or watched anything else besides Ancient Aliens on TV? I mean, what have you done for yourself to give yourself a valid opinion on the subject? And for this, in this case, UFOs. And people will say, "Well, I really haven't done much. And yeah, I catch a couple of things on TV." And I have no problem saying to people, Martin, in that case, you don't have a valid opinion on UFOs, because you haven't spent the time to create an opinion. You're just going by what you've maybe instinctively, or what you just believe inside. People want to believe in something. Everybody wants to believe in something. But that's okay to have a personal belief in something. But isn't it better to know that your opinion is based on what you've really found out on your own, and that would make the water cooler conversation with you much more interesting the next day?
You know, I do agree with that part of it, absolutely. Like, if I'm out and about and the conversation happens to come up, I do have plenty to talk about, that's for sure, without a doubt. And if you're just listening to this show, that means that you probably know more about it in that way that Lee is talking about than the average Joe. Really?
I would hope so. Yeah, I hope that people are really interested in what you present, what I present, what our friend Alejandro presents. We have other colleagues who are on KGRA who are doing the same thing. They just want to present information that will kind of enlarge the scope of the information for the listeners. That's really what we're here for, is to just help people to learn and to maybe be entertained along the way, maybe be mystified along the way. I have been mystified by many things over the past 40 years, and I love telling people about them. Right. And I'm sure that you have too. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So you also want to talk about what James was going on as far as the is it called the phenomenon? Is that the name of it?
Well, you know, a lot of new television series have emerged, as you know, including the recent History Channel show called Unidentified, Inside America's UFO Investigation. And they had a lot of things there that I felt were really well presented to the audience. You know, we now know, in fact, that there have been recent congressional meetings with military pilots about their own close encounters with unidentified aircraft. So over the last couple of years, as you know, I've been working on a new provocative UFO documentary. And yes, you're right, it's going to be called The Phenomenon. I've been doing this with filmmaker James Fox. This will be kind of the third film in his trilogy, his UFO trilogy. The first two films were Out of the Blue, and that was followed by I Know What I Saw. And now we're doing The Phenomenon. And we have just in the last few days, I will say, we've signed a contract with a major media distribution company, and we're looking to have our film released to the public initially as a theatrical release by the end of the year. We're very happy about this.
Wow. So it actually will be out in theaters, you're talking about. That's major.
That's my understanding. And I've been pressing James for more information, and it appears that part of the deal will be to see how well will it do in theaters. And you know, I'll be honest, documentaries don't do all that well in theaters.
Right.
People aren't flocking to buy popcorn and Coke to watch a documentary in a theater. So we're really hoping that this has some far reaching out to the public so that it kind of groks with them and people will resonate with this. But part two of this would be, well, beyond going to a theater, maybe to get this thing on a place like Netflix or the History Channel or other places where it'll have a bigger outreach to people. We just want as many people to see this, because we've gathered some great exclusive information and interviews that won't be seen in other documentaries.
Right, right. And, you know, I got to say, I saw when Jeremy Corbell's Bob Lazar film went out, it was in theaters in at least L.A., and there were people waiting in line to see it. I was surprised to see, you know, that was maybe a test theater or something like that. It's now on Netflix. But you know, listeners, of course, know my mixed feelings about Bob Lazar. But still, I was surprised at the turnout, you know, for that.
Well, I believe it's my understanding that the distribution company that did all the promotional for that film is the same company that's working with us now. And I'm very happy to hear that, because you need the right kind of promotion behind you to get the public to realize that there's something playing in their local theater that maybe you want to see.
Hey, there are people in the chat room that are discussing now about, you know, the previous name, 701. Can you tell them why that name was changed on this film?
Well, the original title for the movie, and this goes back 5 or 6 years ago when James started working on this documentary, it was originally called the 701, and that number came from of the nearly 13,000 UFO cases that the military, the United States Air Force, investigated in their Project Blue Book days back in the 60s, the 50s, and the 60s. Of the 13,000, 701 remained unidentified or unexplained. So that was a number that has always stayed that way. It hasn't changed at all. It's always been 701. So when this film started going through a variety of hands, and James was always with it from the very beginning, when it finally got to his very capable creative hands, he didn't want it to be just recognized as the 701. And we came up with, especially he came up with the idea for the title. We had all kind of contributed what we thought could be good titles. And the phenomenon basically came from one of the early documents in UFO history that I'm always quoting. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. The General Nathan Twining document from 1947, in which he was with the Air Material Command, and he wrote a very famous memo that was classified at the time. And within the memo, he wrote things like, the phenomenon reported is something very real, not fictitious, and it's extraordinary, the phenomenon. And we thought, well, yeah, let's use that phrase, because in the beginning of our film, we're going to be leading up to where the title comes in, and we're leading into it in a very dramatic way that I won't give it away now. But when the title finally appears on the screen, the phenomenon, the audience will go, oh, yeah, I get it.
Well, Lee, thanks so much. And just once, someone was asking, or a number of people were asking, do you have an idea approximately when that, you're just saying by the end of the year, is that all you know right now?
Yeah, all that we know as a timeline, we believe we want this to be distributed, ready for release to the public in around the holiday time, which means that the company is going to do the distribution. They need to have the final product of it from us in their hands about 3 months ahead of time, so they can do everything they need to begin to do the promo work for it. So if we're going to be in theaters in December, they've got to have the film by September, and that's around the corner.
I got it. All right. Hey, thanks so much. I really appreciate you filling in. It's always great talking to you, whether it's on this show,
Martin,
or on the phone. It's always fun.
Thank you, Martin. And have a great conversation with Bruce McAbee. He's one of my favorite people on the planet.
Excellent. All right. You take care.
Don't go away.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Good night, guys.
All right. Good night. All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. So my guest tonight, Bruce McAbee, he hasn't been on for, I think, 6 years or so, a long time. So it's really good to welcome him back. He has quite a background. We're going to be talking about that. He was involved all the way back in the Navy. When he was in the Navy, he was researching UFOs, privately. So we're going to be talking about that and a whole lot more. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Too bad Lee had to go.
Oh, yeah, I know. He's always always a lot of fun. So I'm going to try to boost your audio just a little bit. Bruce, you know, since you have been on, you know, a lot has happened in UFOs in general. And I know that you have done a ton of work on whether it's video or, photograph, analysis. Your background has a lot to do with that. Can you, since you've been on, I have a lot of new listeners. Can you give in a nutshell your background, and we'll get right into your thoughts and what's going on today and what some of the work you did in the past?
Well, I got more or less seriously interested in investigating the subject in the late 1960s, at the time when the Condon Report was going on, funded by the Project Blue Book and the Air Force. And there was a period of time there where you could talk about UFOs without having a bag over your head. But that ended in 1969 when the Air Force closed Project Blue Book, and everybody, including the press, sort of assumed that UFOs had been explained and there was nothing to it, and it was all going away. And then in 1973 it was, we're back. In the summer, late summer, a flap of sightings started in the southeastern United States, and sort of the flap sort of moved around towards the northeast somewhat. And there were a couple of sightings that made national news, the Hicks and Parker abduction in Pascagoula, Mississippi.
And, oh, yeah.
The Larry Coyne helicopter case north of Columbus, Ohio, also made national news. It was unusual for UFO sightings to make it into the national news, and that was two that did. Anyway, at that point, it was clear to me that UFOs weren't going away. I had joined NICAP in the late 60s, and so I was familiar to some extent with what NICAP did, and that got me on some UFO investigations. I went out with people who had done this before and investigated a few cases. It was apparent that I wasn't running up against cases being people being nuts or trying to hoax things and so on. So and after 1973, I began doing my own research work, I guess you could say, starting off statistically with reanalyzing the Special Report 14 of Project Blue Book that had been published about 20 years earlier. I spent time on that. I tackled a photo case known as the McMinnville photo case, McMinnville, Oregon, 1950, Paul Trent and his wife. Got two pictures of an object flying by their farm. The image of the object is large enough and clear enough, so it's either the real thing or a hoax. There's no halfway point. And that was analyzed by William Hartman during the time of the Condon study in 68 and 69. And he concluded that he couldn't prove there wasn't a fake, but it seemed to him that it was real, and he said all things investigated seemed to be consistent with the idea that an extraordinary flying object had gotten past them within the sight of the two Trents. And here it was in a multi-page, hundreds of pages document devoted to all sorts of studies of ufology, and from history to the history of the subject, along with the histories of numerous sightings that they investigated and so on. And this is the one sighting that William Hartman suggested might be real, essentially. And you would think that with a funded organization, funded study like this, funded by the government and carried out at a university, that if they came up with something positive, everybody else would jump on it and see if they were right. But to my greatest surprise, nobody jumped on it. And so I jumped on it to see if I could reproduce what Hartman claimed and also go beyond what he said. And so over the next, from 1974 on to about 77, 78, I did studies of the Trent photos and all the things that go along with it, interviewing them and interviewing people who knew them and doing all the analysis of the theory. This is all on my website, which I might give up right now. It's brumac.mysite.com. That is brumac.mysite.com, brumac.mysite.com. And you can search the site for various, there's 100 megabytes, I guess, of analysis of zillions of sightings ranging from the Trent case, Skylab 3 sighting of UFOs by astronauts, and the 1986 Japan Airlines case, Flight 1628 over Alaska, the 2004 Mexican Air Force sighting over the Yucatan Peninsula, lots of stuff. Gulf Breeze fits in there, other things that many people have never heard of. But anyway, I started doing investigations of various things. One of the most important ones that I did I lucked out, you might say, to be the person investigating the famous New Zealand sightings when they occurred in December 1978, involving people on board an airplane and two radar engineers in the radar room working on board. Anyway, I wrote up a big report on that, and that sort of led me into my contacts with the CIA, which is another serious, interesting story. I might mention that since I was on with you, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago, I published 4 books on the subject. The flagship book is called The FBI-CIA UFO Connection. FBI-CIA UFO Connection. And that's available at Amazon, as are the other ones. The Abduction in My Family is another, the second book. Then 3 Minutes in June, which is the most complete study of the Kenneth Arnold case, analysis of his descriptions and everything else happened with it, plus Fred Johnson, who saw these objects flying overhead just after they went out of sight from Kenneth Arnold. And then the most recent book I published, called 1952, The Legacy of 1952, the Year of the UFO, I've been sort of reliving on Facebook stuff on the year 1952, and most recently, 17 years exactly to the day before the moon landing that we were celebrated last weekend. Flying saucers appeared over Washington, D.C. on the 19th and 20th of July, 1952. There had been a big build-up of sightings throughout the whole United States starting in April of 1952. And by July of 1952, the Blue Book was getting 10 or 20 or 30 sightings a day, far beyond anything they'd ever had before. And then Saturday the 19th, Saturday the 19th of June, of July, I mean, radar unknown radar targets appeared over the Washington, D.C. area, and there were sightings of radar targets and lights during the early morning hours of July 20th. And so things are happening 17 years ago from today. On the 22nd and on the 26th, the next, which would be 17 years ago, next Saturday, where these objects came back again and stayed around for a few hours. They had had jets chasing them, and it made a big flap in the press. The most important outcome of that tremendous concentration of sightings in 1952 was a press conference held by General John Samford, the director of Air Force Intelligence, on Tuesday, the 29th, I think it is, of July, 1952. At any rate, his press conference lasted for over an hour, during which time he said probably the most provocative thing he said was there were incredible people making incredible reports, words to that effect.
Yeah.
Giving some level of credibility to what was going on. Nevertheless, he tried to pawn off the radar detections as results of what's known as anomalous propagation due to temperature inversion.
That's right.
And the temperature inversion effect has an effect on radar beam going out. Radar beam is supposed to stay up in the sky, but if there's too much of a temperature inversion, the radar beam will actually be bent downwards and hit things on the ground, and the only an experienced radar controller will be able to distinguish between what appear to be targets in the air but are actually reflections from ground objects. And you can distinguish between those radar targets that are not real compared to the ones that are. And the experienced radar controllers, weeks and years after these events and General Samford's press conference, they were absolutely confident that what they saw were real hard targets and not radar effects due to the atmosphere.
Yeah, Bruce, I'm afraid we're a little bit late for our break. We're going to have to go into that. So hang in, everyone. We'll be right back. All right, everyone, welcome back. We're trying to work on the audio here on Bruce's side. Hopefully it's a little bit better. Bruce, right before we went to break, you were talking about Sanford back in July of 1952, talking about the radar inversions, and you said that people were actually saying there were hard targets. You want to kind of finish that part of it?
Yes. The radar controllers themselves testified many times over the years that these were hard targets as far as they were concerned. Probably the main importance of the event was General Sanford's press conference, where he tried to explain away everything as natural phenomena, and as far as the radar targets were concerned, he was saying it was all sort of like hot air. At least that's the terminology picked up by the press. It was all hot air. And this became important for the sort of the policy that the Air Force took towards UFOs from then on, namely that there was nothing to it, there was no threat to the United States, forget it, don't tell us anything that we don't want to know about UFOs. And the Air Force nevertheless continued to investigate because they had to fulfill its duty to prove that there was nothing in the sky that could hurt the United States. But anyway, that was 1952, 17 years ago, and we're still struggling under the hot air syndrome, you might say.
Right. Now, and back, a lot of people will look at the images of the Capitol building with the lights over it, and that actually is that's actually an inversion of lights, isn't it? Up in the sky, that picture that you so often see, it has nothing to do with UFOs, even though it was happening at that time. Am I right about that?
Well, I can't imagine an inversion of lights. That is, lights on the ground that are seen somehow by the closest you could get would be a mirage, and the angular separation between the object of the mirage and the mirage image itself has to be less than a degree to be real. So these images of lights up there above the Capitol are many degrees above the horizontal. So I don't know about these pictures that have been floating around of the object flying past the Capitol. A mirage, that's for sure.
Yeah. I was loosely calling it an inversion just because I didn't know what to call it. It's not, it's not like a lens flare or anything like that, but it was, those pictures that people see online. If you search for 1952, UFOs over Washington, that's what you'll come up with. And it basically lines up with the streetlights perfectly up in the sky. However that was done, I have no idea, but those aren't...
That's a single picture you're talking about?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I'm talking about a movie of lights moving past from left to right, moving past the Capitol.
Oh, okay. I think I've seen that as well. Wow. Yeah, but that was really...
The picture you're talking about, taken from the sort of the rear of the Capitol building, looking towards the Capitol and seeing lights up in the sky, and very bright lights, greatly overexposed at ground level. Those are known as flares, lens flares, where they get a reflection in the optics of the camera, a reflection that takes some light from an actual light source, extremely bright, and reflects it over to some angle away from the center of the photo, making a dimmer image, which is usually not seen, but can be seen if there's a dark background. Then the flare can be seen on superimposed on the background. But anyway, the picture you're talking about, I'm familiar with, and as I said, that's a result of lens flares causing reflection images that appear in the sky but are not actually in the sky.
Right, right. So actually, I had it when I said it wasn't lens flares, I was wrong. It actually is lens flares. But
right.
Yeah, but we're both talking about the same picture, which is interesting. But 52 was really you know, a year where there was a crazy amount of sightings, you know, to the point where, you know, it did bring that you know, it did change a lot of things as far as people taking a hard look at it. And, you know,
Sanford's. The FBI file, which I got in 1977, and which is sort of summarized in the book, The FBI CIA UFO Connection. The FBI file has some documents in the fall of 1971 document on the same day as General Sanford's press conference. An FBI agent went to the Office of Air Force Intelligence. And to interview, find out what was going on with all these sightings. And the agent was told that a couple of percent, 4 to 5% of the sightings could not be explained, and that some top-level Air Force people were seriously considering interplanetary ships, to use a phraseology that's in the document. So that was pretty interesting. And also in 1952, there were so many sightings, the CIA got involved. And that was that's summarized also in my book. Those were a lot of sightings and things that happened in the 50s. The last part of the book discusses my direct interactions with the CIA, which began in 1979 when I was looking for some help in analyzing the radar detections in the New Zealand sightings of December 78. And it was suggested by a person that I knew that I could go to the CIA maybe and get some help on radar. And so I went there and explained to about a half a dozen gentlemen who sat there listening what I knew about the New Zealand sightings. And later on I visited the CIA two or three times in 1979, got some information, but it really didn't make much of an impression on me. I never expected to go back there again, but just so happened that 5 years later, I got a phone call from a CIA guy who was interested in the Navy work I was doing. All his UFO stuff was independent of the Navy, of course. The Navy work I was doing at that time was generating underwater sound using high-power laser beams, zapping the water to create sound. And this CIA agent had been studying comparable papers out of the Soviet Union. He wanted to know whether we were keeping up with the Russians or not. And so he contacted me, and I went there. Well, on the first phone call, he asked me if I could do it. I said, sure, I'd be happy to give a description of what we're doing. And a few hours later, he called me up with details on when I should be there and all that. And after talking to business, he then says, I understand you've been here before. And my jaw nearly hit the floor because I had not intended to say anything about being at the CIA to discuss UFOs. So my cover had been blown, you might say. And for the next 10 years or so, I had a considerable interaction with this guy on the UFO subject at the same time we were talking about laser-generated underwater sound.
There was someone that contacted me one time that thought that you may have actually worked for the CIA involving UFOs in some like private capacity. Is that just a rumor?
Well, I didn't work for the CIA in the implication of getting paid or something like that. I shared with them some information that I got, and this guy was apparently interested in the subject himself. I found virtually every defense installation or whatever I went to over the years that I was with the Navy, there were people who were interested in this subject, and they would talk about it in whispering tones.
Yeah.
Nobody was overtly interested in it, you might say, but you would find out that there would be a little group of people who would get together late, and that happened in just about every defense installation that I was at.
Bruce, someone wanted to know what the laser sound was actually for.
We were investigating this for a number of things, but one of the biggies was anti-submarine warfare, ASW, where you could use the laser beam from an airplane, beam it down onto the surface of the water, generate sound at the surface of the water that goes down into the water, and goes down to where some submarine with a sensitive hydrophone can be listening, and you could send a signal from the airplane directly to the submarine by using this interface method of generating a series of pulses, of laser pulses on the surface that generate a series of acoustic pulses in the body of water underneath the surface. Then there were also potentiality for using for searching out for mines and other things like that. But that was the main driver, was the ASW situation. And that was the interest also of the CIA, because they could see the Soviets doing the same sort of work we were doing, measuring how far you could transmit a pulse in the water if you create it with a laser beam.
Interesting. Wow. And is this something that actually was used or is used in any type of way currently?
At the time we were investigating this, the Navy was looking for a way to signal submarines anywhere under the surface when they were down to some depth. And we knew they were working on a project called Sanguine that had to do with sending low-frequency electromagnetic signals out into the ocean to contact submarines. And there was sort of a minor race, you might say, between what we were doing and what they were doing with the electromagnetic. And the Project Sanguine methods finally ended up working, and so they didn't need to worry about generating sound from above with an airplane. So it never got used, you might say.
Wow, that's really interesting. So, since the last time we've talked, actually, there's so much more technology out there today. I'm not really talking about anything to do with photo or video, but in detection, I'm sure you keep up on that stuff. For instance, the Navy, what the Navy has and why the Navy is actually seeing a lot more than they've ever seen before in the skies, because of the different, the different equipment that they have and who knows what the future is going to bring as far as technology goes. Have you been keeping up on that?
One of the key things in this recent revelation about the Nimitz events in 2004, November of 2004, Kevin Day, the guy who was the radar operator, was telling me about tracking these objects. And they had the spy radar, which is a multi-beam radar, so you can track several different things at the same time. At high speed, if you want. What he told me could not have been determined, say, 10 or 20 years earlier before spy radar was available. I forget what the first ship with the spy radar on it.
The Princeton, I believe.
Sometime in the late 90s, I guess it was.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Mm-hmm.
When they first had... The first ship was Ticonderoga, sticks in my mind, but that might not be it. At any rate, it was well proven by the time it was being used by Kevin Day on the on the Princeton using the spy radar, and he was able to measure these objects that were traveling at 28,000 feet altitude, going 100 knots, which is a crash velocity at 28,000 feet. The air is so thin up there that you got to go at high speed in order to be able to
get lift
an airplane up. Yeah. Shoving air down. Mm. Shoving air down at a high speed holds the plane up. And if you're not going fast enough, you're not shoving enough air down to hold the plane up. But these things are going along calmly, and when some F-18 jets approached, they started dropping downwards, and he said they had dropped down to the surface of the Earth ocean about 50 feet, and he estimated 0.78 seconds, about 8-tenths of a second. They would drop from 28,000 feet to 50 feet. That's a considerable distance to travel in less than a second.
I'll say.
0.4 of a second. I calculated if this were Newtonian mechanics we were talking about, and some object was pushing me, pushing one of these things downwards to go halfway, accelerating halfway to get as far as quickly as you can to the halfway point, and then decelerating from the halfway point to the end point. And if you calculate like this, you come up with some 1,000 G's or something like that of acceleration necessary to cover that distance and from 28,000 feet down to 0 feet, hovering at 50 feet, I should say.
Wow.
Covering that distance in less than 8-tenths of a second. It requires a couple of thousand G's to get up to the speed that you're reaching when you're at the halfway point. And then you slam on the brakes, and I really mean slam on the brakes, reverse your thrust or whatever, and slow down so that you stop 50 feet above the water.
Yeah.
You can think of other ways of getting from point A to point B, a lot of different ways of getting from point A to point B, but the halfway mark, accelerate to the halfway point, then decelerate to the end point, gives you an estimate of what sort of acceleration you have to have, and it's huge. So
yeah.
These objects were able to do that, and then they sort of meandered back up to the top, 28,000 feet again. Anyway, we were talking about the capability of the instruments to detect that, and you wouldn't have been able to see that with the ordinary radars they had in the old days, where you have a single beam that's rotating around.
Oh yeah,
and you're seeing blips appear on the radar screen every time the beam goes around.
Mm-hmm.
With a spy radar, you can lock a beam on, and that's my understanding. You can lock on a beam and just let it track whatever you lock it onto.
That's right. Now, another point in that in particular is if you had any type of craft that could travel those speeds, it would completely fall apart just with a 1,000 G's. It's just not even – never mind a being inside of it. Just the craft itself, I would think, it would shatter with that force. I mean, I don't know. It just seemed logical that it would.
Well, it was one of the things which occurred to none other than Kenneth Arnold when he thought about his sighting back in June 24th, 1947. He observed these objects in their very jerky motions as they traveled along, as he compared with a saucer skipping on the water.
Mm.
And that's where the term flying saucer came from. If you go back, you read my book, The 3 Minutes in June, and you'll see the complete story about Kenneth Arnold and a deep analysis of his sighting. But one of his first thoughts was these things were so jerky that they would going at such a high speed and changing directions that they would turn a human being into a mush very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's sort of the thing that these new recent admissions by the TTSA people, Louis Elizondo and so on, that these objects have very jerky motion. David Fravor, who was the one of the F-18 pilots to see this thing called Tic Tac, said it was traveling along in a bouncing way, like a ping pong ball bouncing off the wall, where you have a very sudden change in direction, and you go along at some velocity, and suddenly you change direction into some other direction, and the change in direction requires extreme acceleration to do that. That's enough to turn a human being into a jelly. That was already known, by the way, way back in 1947. Yeah. The first part of this broadcast, Lee Spiegel talked about General Nathan Twining's letter that talked about the phenomenon as being real and not fictitious or imaginary. And already by that time, when he wrote that letter in September of 1947, they knew that these objects had very strange characteristics, such as being able to suddenly appear as if dropping down from a high altitude, so suddenly be able to disappear almost like disintegration as they took off. Capability of high speed and no recognizable features that indicate it was like an airplane at all. That's all that stuff that has been emphasized as characteristics in recent discussions by the TTSA people. That was all known back in 1947.
Yeah.
So I've asked the question, what have we learned in the last 72 years?
One of the things, we're just about ready to go into break here in just a minute, but one of the things I have argued more or less when it comes to people saying, oh, this is just, you know, new technology, could be China, could be Russia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I will bring up the subject, what about people saying the exact same things or exact capabilities, you know, 50 years ago? How would you explain that? Because if something was out for 50 years, we certainly would know about it by now, you would think. But I think we're just about ready to go into break here. So we might as well go ahead and do that. This is Martin Willis. My guest tonight is Dr. Bruce Maccabee, and we'll be right back. Thank you so much for listening to the show. Remember, there's a new way to support the show, especially if you're not a fan of PayPal, not through our subscription site. Well, you can do that, but also through Patreon. That link is right on our website, podcastufo.com. We also have a blog over there, too. You can check that out. And it absolutely goes along with today's show. It has to do with good old-fashioned UFO photo analysis, and that's by Charles Lear. Check that out. So we'll be back next week, but it will not be a live show. It will be a repeat of back in 2013, and then we'll be back live as usual after that. Thanks so much, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.